For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It is January the 7th. We are in Shmuel Beis, Perek Yud Beis, chapter 12. We're in the middle of the Perek. We're up to Pasuk Tezayin 16. Nathan already came to David and told him the mashal, told him the parable of the wealthy man and the poor man, and how the wealthy man took advantage of the poor man. And David pronounced that the death to the wealthy man, and that he should also have to pay back quadruple what he took. And then Nathan told David that you are that man, and because of what you did, Hashem said that you are going to be punished. I did so much good for you, and you degraded the word of Hashem. So now the sword will not leave your house forever, because you did these terrible things. And he listed what he did wrong, getting Uriah killed, and taking his wife, etc. And you did this in private. You're going to get punished publicly. And then David's response is, Chatasi laHashem, I sinned to Hashem. It's demonstrating his ability to immediately own up and to say he sinned, which is actually, we didn't mention this last time. I don't think we mentioned last time that this is something that is in the family of Yehuda, because that's what Yehuda did as well. That when, right, we didn't mention that with Tamar. Okay, fine. So, and then Nathan said to David, Hashem has removed your sin. You will not die because you admitted. However, because you did do this thing, you did anger Hashem, therefore the son that was born is going to die. That's going to be the first of the quadruple punishment for David. He's going to pay with it with four of his children. And this is the first one, that the child that was born, as we mentioned, that child should have been Mashiach. That child is going to die. The child was born from Bathsheba. And the last thing we read was Pasuk Tezva, verse 15, that Nathan went home, and Hashem struck the child that Bathsheba had, and he became sick. So he hasn't died yet, but he's very sick. So now we're up to Pasuk Tezayin, verse 16. David sought out Hashem on behalf of the child. He davened to Hashem. Vayatsam David som, and David fasted. Uva vilan v'shachav arza, and he came and he slept and he lay down on the ground. When he went to sleep at night, he lay down on the ground. So David does not accept the punishment, which means that he doesn't accept that it has to happen. He decides to try to stop it from happening. And he fasts, he davens, and he sleeps on the floor. Vayakumu ziknei veso alav, and the elders of his house got up upon him, lahakimo min ha'aretz, to get him up on the ground. Velo avai, didn't want to. Velo vara itam lachem, he did not eat bread with them either. He didn't take his meals with people. He was fasting. Vayhi bayom ha'shvi, and on the seventh day, bayom ha'tayolad, and then the child died. So David's efforts did not spare the child. Vayiru avdei David lahagidlo kimeis hayaled. The servants of David were afraid to tell him that the child died. Kiamu, because they said, hinei biyos hayaled chai, when the child was alive, dibayinu eilav v'lo shama v'kolayinu, we spoke to him, he didn't listen to us. Veich nomer eilav meis hayaled, how could we tell him the child died? Tzuguzunt, v'asara. And it'll be bad for him. Like now, it's going to be even worse. Vayar David ki avad of mizbach Hashem. David saw his servants were whispering, and David was no fool. Vayavin David ki meis hayaled. David understood the child must have died. Vayomer David avadav hameis hayaled. David said to his servants, did the child die? Vayomru meis. They said he died. Vayakam David meharetz. David got up from the ground. Vayirchatz, and he washed. Vayasech, and he anointed himself. Vayechalef simlosav, and he changed his clothes. Vayavo veis Hashem, and he came to the house of Hashem. Vayishtachu, and he bowed. Vayavoel Beiso, and he came back to his house. Vayishal, and he asked, Vayosimu bo lechem, and they gave him bread, Vayochal, and he ate. So now the child is dead, now David is acting normally. So it's the reverse of what people normally do. Right? Normally, if a person loses a relative, God forbid, then they go into Shiva. David seems to have done the Shiva thing before the child died, and then when the child died, he's now acting normally. So his servant said to him, Ma ha-davar ha-zeh ha-shasiso, what is this thing that you've done? On behalf of the child who was alive, you fasted and you cried. When the child died, you got up and you ate bread. And he said, as long as the child was alive, I fasted and I cried. I said, who knows? Maybe Hashem will be gracious to me and the child will live. And now, he died. Why should I fast? Could I bring him back again? I'm going to go to him. He's not coming back to me. I'm going to go to him. He's not going to go back to me. This is obviously a statement that stands for all time. Right? We go to those who are dead. Those who are dead don't come to us. Everybody ends up dying. So everybody ends up on that side of the fence. So we are going to those who have already passed on. They're not coming back to us. Vayinachem David es bas sheva ishto. David consoled bas sheva, his wife. Vayavo eleha vayishka vima. So he was intimate with her. Vatelet bain. And she gave birth to a son. So this is the second son that she has. Vatikra es shemo shlomo. She called his name Shlomo. There's two ways of doing this. Vayikra or Vatikra. It says Vayikra. We read it Vatikra. Vayikra means that he called his name Shlomo. And we read it Vatikra. She called his name Shlomo. The drasha is that Hashem called his name Shlomo. Vahashem ahivo, and Hashem loved him. Hashem loved this child. Vayishtach biyad Natan Hanavi, Hashem sent in the hands of Natan Hanavi. Vayikra es Shemo Yedidya, and she called his name, Hashem called his name Yedidya. Yedid means beloved, and of course the last two letters, Ka, is Hashem's name, the beloved of Hashem. Bavur Hashem, on behalf of Hashem. So Shlomo is born. Hashem loves this child and gives him another name, Yedidya, the beloved of Hashem. So Shlomo, which means peace, which of course we know that Shalom is one of the names of Hashem. And in addition to that, Yedidya, the beloved of Hashem. So Shlomo starts off his life, he's a baby, but he starts off with great love and great encouragement from Hashem. And Shlomo is going to be in a very, very talented person. We know about his wisdom, of course, but he's going to be an extremely talented person. And Hashem clearly is showing great favor to Shlomo.
And also because he left Hashem, which shows us.
Well, that comes later on. I mean, that's later on in his life. Right now, we're just starting off his life. But we're not done with the story. We're still in the middle of the story. You would have thought, okay, it's over. We finished. But we didn't finish. What about Rabbah? That city that they were laying siege to, it was supposed to be the final straw, the final piece of getting all of the enemies of the Jewish people subdued so that then the Mashiach could build the Beis HaMikdash, or now not Mashiach, but Shlomo. So there's this one last city, one last country, Ammon, and Rabbah is the main city. So Yoav now wages war with Rabbah's Bnei Ammon, Rabbah of Bnei Ammon, Vayil Kodes Ira Malucha, and he captured the city of the king. We mentioned this before, that Rabbah had it was a double-walled city. There was the main city, which was walled, and then there was an inner city, which was walled again. So this is the outer city that Yoav captured. He captured the outer one, which is the main part of the city. Now there's just a very small inner city that's also walled, which Yoav could have easily conquered. But instead, Vayishlach Yoav Malachim El David, Yoav sent messengers to David, Vayomer, and he said, Milchamti berabba, I made war with Rabba. Gam vachanati asir hamayim, I also captured the city of the water. The outer city had this spring of water that provided water for the city, which means that the inner city can't last very long because they don't have any water source. So I've not only have I captured the outer city, I've also cut off the water source to the inner city. Ve'ata, and now, as Sofes Yasser Ha'am, gather the rest of the nation, Vachanei al Ha'ir V'lachta, and you, David, should come and lay siege to the inner city and capture it. Why? Pen al Korani Yasser, lest I capture the inner city, V'nikra Shmi Aleha, and my name will be called upon it. It shouldn't be that I am known as the one who captured Rabbah. It shouldn't be me. That would be inappropriate. Vayesov David es kol ha'am, and David gathered all of the nation. Vayelech Rabasa, and he went to Rabbah. Vayilachem ba, and he waged war to it. Vayil kida, and he captured it. David is the one, not Yoav, but David is the one who captured the city. We should remember this act of Yoav over here. How Yoav is so. It's important to Yoav that David be the one to capture the city. Vayikach es ateres malkam me'al rosho, and he took the crown of their king from upon his head. Umishkala kikar zahav, its weight was a kikar of gold. That is a massive chunk of gold. That's a huge amount of gold. Just to give you a sense, the menorah in the Mishkan, which, remember, Aaron had to stand on steps to stand up on it to light it, which stood on the floor. So it's this floor basement, big menorah that Aaron had to stand on the steps to light. The menorah was a kikar of gold. Now, the weights and measures of the Beis HaMikdash and the Mishkan were sometimes double that of regular ones, so that like when it comes to some of the measures are sometimes doubled, like the when you read about the amount of money that they collected in Parshas Pekudei, they collected the amount of money they collected of silver and gold and all that. So it uses different denominations. Those denominations should be understood as double what they are for regular people. So it could be that the kikar over here is really only half the amount of gold, but it's still a gigantic amount of gold to put on your head.
Heavy.
It's very heavy, right?
Why was it double?
Okay, that's just because of Hekdesh, because in the Beis HaMikdash, so they used larger. Everything in those days was a little bit wasn't as uniform as things are today, and they used a better type, a bigger type. But okay, that's
a different standard,
right? The Evin Yakara, it also had a very precious stone, so it had all this gold and a precious stone. So he took it off the head of their king, Batihi al Rosh David, and it was on the head of David. Ushlal Ha'ir, and the spoils of the city, Hotzi, he took out, Har Be'ma'od, very, very much. Now here we have a departure from what has happened in the past. In the past, all of the gold, silver, everything that David captured from all of the cities and all of the countries that he conquered, he took all that wealth and brought it to Yerushalayim to be used for the Beis HaMikdash. This is the exception. This becomes the crown of David. The Ha'am Asher Ba, and this people in Rabbah, Hotzi he took out, Vayasem Ba Megeira Uvacharitze HaBarzel Uvemagziros HaBarzel, and he put them in, these are various sharp objects. I don't know the exact translation of each of these things, but they were meant to inflict pain upon the people. He took them out and he did. Now, whether it means that he actually caused them physical pain by hurting them with these things, or whether it means he made them, he put them to this type of hard labor in working these things, either way, it was to set an example from showing, making them an example out of them, and he subjected them to very difficult afflictions. The Havir Osam Bamal Bain, and he dragged them, Rashi literally says, through the mud, meaning he made them very degraded. And so he did to all the cities of the Bnei Ammon. And David returned with all the nation to Yerushalayim. And so ends the episode of David and Bathsheba. And at the end of the entire episode, we have Shlomo HaMelech, but we do not have Mashiach. That's the end of the whole episode. The next 8 prakim, the next 8 chapters, will deal with the fallout from this episode. We only had one of the quadruple punishment that David's going to get. Now we have to deal with the other 3. And there's going to be one problem after another. David is going to encounter all kinds of problems with his children because of this episode. And that will be the next 8 chapters of Shmuel Beis. So that we have to deal with separately. But right now, we have to deal with what has happened over here. I'll take a question in just a moment. What has happened over here with the child and David trying to save the child and then getting up and then having Shlomo, and what is the whole story with Rabbah over here and with David, Yoav not wanting to capture the city, rather David doing it, and this crown, etc. So this we have to deal with now tonight.
I mean, it's really, I guess it's premature. It just bothered me ahead of time because these children are grown up. I mean, they have free will.
No, we have to deal with that separately. That is an issue. We have to deal with that separately. How do you punish someone using the free will of somebody? Right. We have to get to that. That's going to be an issue. So far, it's just a child having been killed by Hashem. Mm-hmm. So it's not that someone rebelled, like Avshalom's going to rebel. Right. Then we have to deal with that separately. Okay. Now,
Is there something to do with the 7-day period? Because 7 seems pretty auspicious.
Yeah.
And do we know if he hadn't done what he did, would the child have lived all
7 days? If he hadn't done...
Would the Mashiach child have lived the 7 days if David hadn't fasted and prayed?
Oh, then I don't know. Would he have died right away or would he have lived 7 days? I don't know. Obviously, if he didn't do the sin with Bathsheba, this child would have grown up and been Mashiach. It was David and Bathsheba's child.
This one that died?
Yeah. This is Shlomo Melech's older brother. Now, we learned before that the Gemara tells us, we started off the whole episode with this, that the Gemara tells us that David was not roi lo somaisa. He was not fit for what happened over here. This should never have happened. David was above all of this that happened. He really was in control of his yetzer hara, of his evil inclination, and all of this should never have happened. We explained what happened because he asked to be tested, which he shouldn't have asked to be tested, and then it all spiraled downward from there. But the Gemara says that at the end of the day, the reason why it happened was to teach us teshuvah. David becomes the paradigm of teshuvah. Now, the Gemara does not mean to say that David really could have not sinned, but he deliberately sinned in order to teach us teshuvah. Why does it mean that? You're not allowed to deliberately sin for any reason. You're never allowed to deliberately sin. There's a very, very rare case of an avera lishma, of doing an avera, doing a sin for a good purpose, but that's just another way of saying that sometimes, in very, very rare situations, there are priorities that, you know, there's conflicting priorities, and either way, it's the better of two evils, right? Which is a different discussion, not for now. You find that with Yael back in the story of Devorah in Shoftim. But that's not for now.
But you also find it with the wood gatherer?
Well, he thought so, but he was wrong.
Right.
No, but there you find it in a correct way.
Okay,
but that's a whole separate discussion. But what the Gemara means to say is that at the end of the whole story, we learn from David to Shuvah. David wanted to be tested because David said, why are they going to say Elokei Abraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov, and they're not going to say Elokei David? So Hashem said, you were never tested. So David said, okay, test me. And he really could have passed the test. He really was great enough, but he shouldn't have asked to be tested. So we don't end up with saying Elokei David. It could be, had he never asked to be tested, perhaps he would have been tested and we would have ended up saying Elokei David.
Why was it so important for us to pray with him?
I know we talked about it already a few weeks ago. But in the end of the whole story, what we do get from David is he becomes the example of tshuva, of doing tshuva. Now, where do we see this, that he becomes the paradigm of teshuva. So already we see it from Chatasi LaHashem. I sin to Hashem. He owns up, which is the very first step in teshuva. You can't do teshuva if you don't admit you did something wrong. So the first thing is we have to be honest with ourselves and honest with HaKadosh Baruch Hu to say, I sinned. And that's what vidui is. Vidui is confession. I did it. I admit that I did it. I am not going to whitewash my actions. I was bad. I did something wrong. I'm not going to excuse myself. I'm not going to say, yeah, but I had this and this and that. I sinned. Let's strip it all away. At the end of the day, I did what I shouldn't have done. That's David's first lesson to all of us. But David goes further. David goes further than that. Let's just set up where David had been and what happened. David was on the cusp of fulfilling the dreams of all of Klal Yisrael. David was on the cusp of fulfilling the purpose, the mission for why Hashem created the whole world. That's pretty significant. I don't know if you can get more significant than that. David was on the cusp. He really was there. He had the entire Sefer has shown David growing, developing his incredible, just unbelievable, his giving himself over to Hashem, his trust and belief in Hashem. The way we saw how he dealt with Sheol, how he wouldn't let anybody touch Sheol, said, it's not our business, it's up to Hashem. That we've seen so much greatness from David, and how he's developed further and greater and greater and greater and greater and greater. And he's at a point now where it's one last tiny step to take. We're really on the cusp. He jumped the gun with Bathsheba. But we know he was supposed to marry Bathsheba, or he was supposed to get killed in this battle. So how much did David jump the gun? By how much? By a month? By a week? By a day? I don't know. It was really close. It was really, really close that David, had he not taken this step, he was so close, then he would have passed the test, because he had the strength to pass the test. He already had subdued his Yetzer Hara. He was in total control of his actions. He would have definitely passed the test, because he could have done it. Uriah would have been killed in battle. He would have married Bathsheba. They would have had Mashiach. He would have grown up and built the base. Everything would have been great. He was on the cusp, literally. And he blew it. He absolutely blew it. Now, when a person is so close to such intense greatness, David was already great, but this would have been another step. This would have been taking it to the highest level. A person is on the cusp of incredible greatness, and they blow it. And they're not going to get a second chance. He's not going to get a second chance. That's it. Now, we have Shlomo HaMelech, who's a great man, but he's not Mashiach, and we're still waiting for Mashiach. We're waiting for Mashiach. It's thousands of years later. When that happens, it is not uncommon for a person to fall precipitously, because they're on such a high, about to do it, and boom, they blow it. And now, forget it. Forget it. Forget it. It's all over. I don't want to deal with it. Forget it. They can't deal with changing their mindset. They can't now reassess and recalibrate and say, okay, I messed up there, but I'm going to try this now. Very often a person just drops. The primary example of that is Arpa. Arpa could have been like Rus. She was right there. We learned about this when we learned Megillas Rus. She was right there. And she couldn't do it. And she turned around and went back. And the Gemara says that the night that she left, Nami, she just totally let go of everything, and she acted completely immorally with, the Gemara says, 100 men and a dog. So who knows whether it's being exaggerated, but whatever it is, the point is she just completely lost it. And I imagine everybody in this room has seen this happen, where a person is on such a high and then they get derailed and they just drop like a ton of bricks. David won't let that happen. Not only does he do teshuva in the sense that he owns up, but he says, okay, I own up, I did something wrong, and now it's time to move on. It's time to, I'm not giving up my service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I'm not saying that it's all over. Okay, so now plan B. There's plan B. So what's plan B? The truth is he has plan B and he has plan C. Plan B is, okay, the kid is sick. The child is sick. But it ain't over till it's over. That wasn't said by Yogi Berra. That was said by David HaMelech. Right? Because the child's still alive. And who knows? Who knows? Maybe I can do teshuva right here and right now and actually overturn the terrible deed that I did. So he cries and he fasts and he just pours out his heart to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he won't eat and he lies on the floor and he's just completely trying to overturn things. One could have said he's depressed, but he's not depressed. The proof he's not depressed is because when the child dies, he snaps out of it. So clearly this is a premeditated act. He is saying, I am going to try my best to overturn the Gezerah. Just like Moshe Rabbeinu, when he was told, you are not going into Eretz Yisrael, he davened and davened and davened and davened and davened, and Hashem has to tell him, stop. Stop. I'm not letting you go in. Until Hashem tells him to stop, he doesn't stop. And David is not going, he's relentless. He's going to try to get this child to live. The Gemara says that attributed to David HaMelech and his line from then on, from this episode on, the Gemara says that his descendants would say that Kach mekublani mi beis Abba, so I have accepted, I've been transmitted from the house of my father, meaning from David HaMelech, afilu cherev chada munachas atzavaro shel adam, even if a sharp sword is lying on the throat of a person, al yimna atzmo min harachamim, he should not withhold himself from begging for mercy from Hashem, not from the person with the sword, from Hashem. Because even if it seems like, okay, it's all over, it doesn't matter. It still can change. David knows Hashem can change everything in the blink of an eye, and there's no difference to HaKadosh Baruch Hu between, there's no such thing as hard. Everything is simple. Everything is easy. Everything is instantaneous. Everything is at his disposal. And therefore, if the child is still alive, it's not irreversible. And I am going to try to do everything possible. But when the child dies, David gets up. Says, okay. Obviously, plan B is also wrong. Plan A, I messed up. Maybe plan B would work. No, Hashem said no. Fine. On to plan C. What, am I going to sit here and cry some more? He's gone. He's not coming back to me. I'm going to him. He's not coming back to me. I'm going to him. He's not coming to me. And therefore, David says, that's it. It's time to move on. So he therefore says, it's time for plan B. It's not going to be Mashiach. So it's going to be another child who's going to be my successor, who's going to build the Beis HaMikdash, and Klal Yisrael will move on from there. So he goes to Bathsheba. The Medjur says that when he came to Bathsheba, Bathsheba said to him that, I don't want to produce another child with you, because look what happened to the first one. Evidently, it was a terrible sin, and Hashem killed the child. So perhaps we shouldn't have any more children. So David explained to her, it was a sin, and it was a mistake, and this is what happened, but we move on. And we don't say that now it's all over. We say that, okay, we did wrong, we did teshuva, and now we continue. And Hashem wants us to have a child. That's why it says he consoled her. And they go on, they have a child, Shlomo, and now David is ready to raise Shlomo in a way that will best prepare him to be the successor of David. And he will do so for 12 years, then David is going to die. Shlomo takes over the throne at the age of 12. That we'll get to much later. So David is teaching us teshuva not only in doing teshuva and owning up in admitting the sin, he's also showing us what you do with the fact that you sin. There's no room for depression. My Rebbe used to say Yush. Yush means depression. Yush is spelled Yud, Aleph, Vav, Shin. Yush. So he used to say Yush is a four-letter word. So he used to say, we don't believe in Yush. We don't believe in that. We don't give up. We don't give up. We don't We don't succumb to depression. Yes, it went wrong. It was my fault that it went wrong. Fine. And I'm wrong for doing it. I'm going to get punished for doing it. And I have to do tshuva for doing it. But it doesn't mean that I'm no longer a servant of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I am still a servant of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem still loves me. He still wants the best from me. And He still has expectations from me. And it's my job to follow through the best I can, even though I messed up terribly. But it's not the end of the world. So this we learn from David HaMelech. This is David teaching us teshuvah, not just doing teshuvah, but how to handle oneself when one faces reality, that I blew it. I blew it. But it's not the end of the world. I move on. Now, we then have to deal with the city of Rabbah. So this is the last city. And we discussed this in previous classes, that everything was supposed to, everything centers around this city, because this is the final step in subduing all the nations around Eretz Yisrael. And then, and as the pasuk says in the Chumash, that when Hashem is v'hiniach lachem mikol oyveichem misaviv v'shavtem be'etach, it'll be when Hashem gives you serenity from all the nations around you, then you'll build the Beis HaMikdash. So Mashiach had to be born through this episode, and it was supposed to be through the death of Uriah, through David marrying Bathsheba, having Mashiach. So the Beis HaMikdash is still going to be a result of this battle. So Yoav now conquers the city, which of course was going to happen. Yoav was of course going to be able to conquer the city, and he does, but Yoav says, it's not my victory, it is David's victory. Because at the end of the day, the conquering of this city is the trigger of the building of the Beis HaMikdash. It's also the trigger of Mashiach. Maybe not now in the next generation, now it's going to be many generations later, but it is the trigger of Malchus based of it. It is through the destruction of this city that we now move on to David passing the torch to the next generation. This is it. The Beis HaMikdash is going to be built through the destruction of this city. That can't be through me, says Yoav. That can't be through the general. That has to be through the top. That has to be through David HaMelech. David, the Mashiach is not built by the Kohanim. The Beis HaMikdash is not built by the Kohanim. The Kohanim work in the Beis HaMikdash. Who would you say is in charge of the Beis HaMikdash? Wouldn't you say the Kohen Gadol is in charge? Wouldn't you say, if you had to pick a person who runs the Beis HaMikdash, who's in charge, you'd say the Kohen Gadol, which is true. But the Beis HaMikdash is built by the king. The king's job is to wipe out Amalek and build the Beis HaMikdash. Those are two jobs that he has to do. Therefore, since the defeat of this city is the trigger to the building of the Beis HaMikdash, it must come through David. And Yoav recognizes that. Yoav is not power hungry. Yoav understands that David is in charge, and that Yoav's battling enables David, and David's Torah enables Yoav. They all understand this. And David, Yoav now steps back and says, David, you've got to come and conquer the city. David comes and he conquers the city. Then he takes the crown. Now, so far, the simple reading of this crown is the same idea. It's true that all of the spoils of war until now were put into the treasury to be used for the Beis HaMikdash. But the final straw, the last battle, the one that now triggers the Beis HaMikdash, which comes through David, the crown of that king will now get transferred to David's head. Because now it's going to show that all nations are subdued under the Jewish king. So that final king that they beat, that crown, which seems to be the most gaudy of all the crowns, with this unbelievable amount of gold, that gets put on David's head. It is not coincidental that Ammon has all this gold, because Ammon was apparently the most powerful of all the nations in the time of David. And I'll show you how we know that. But before we do that, let me tell you the other explanation for this crown of gold. Let's look at Pasuk Lamed, verse 30 again. Vayikach et ateres malkam, and he took the crown of their king. Me'al rosho, from upon his head. Now, how does David wear this crown of gold if it's so heavy? And how did their king wear the crown of gold if it's heavy? So, the Gemara says, the Medrash says, that David didn't actually wear the crown. It was suspended over the throne of David. And when David sat in his throne, the crown was above him. That's what the Medrash says. The Medrash says that there was some... The gold had this precious stone, and the precious stone was able to be held up by a magnet. There was some, or some, something like that. Some sort of a way of holding up the crown. It was suspended, and David sat underneath the crown. But he didn't actually wear it because it would be too heavy. But what about the king of Ammon? How did he wear it if it's so heavy? So the Gemara says, Malkam does not mean their king. Malkam means their avodah zarah, their idol. Because we know that one of the avodah zarahs that are mentioned in the Chumash is Molech. Molech is the one where they give the children over to Molech in the fire. And it had this, they had this massive statue with this massive crown, and David removes it and takes it and puts it over his own head. Now, what is the symbolism in that? The first problem you have is, how could he do that? That which is used for avodah zarah becomes asur b'hanah. You're not allowed to derive any benefit from it. It has to be destroyed. So how could one do that? So the Gemara tells us, we know this is true, before this point, we know that the rule is that a non-Jew can be mevatel avodah zarah. Mevatel means to nullify it. If you have something, if you're walking on the road and you find a statue, you find an icon which was clearly worshipped, you're in the Far East, and these things are worshipped, they're really worshipped, and you find an icon, but you find it smashed to pieces on the ground, you're allowed to derive benefit from it. You're allowed to take it home, sell it, whatever it is, derive benefit from the precious metals. You can derive benefit from it. Why? Because the non-Jew clearly, as the Gemara says, got angry at his God and said, "You good for nothing God," and he smashed it. So that means he was mevatel, he nullified the avodah zarah. A Jew can't nullify avodah zarah, but a non-Jew can. We're going to learn later that one of David's top, I don't want to use the word advisors, I want to use supporters. And we'll see, we're going to deal with him when we get to the rebellion of Absalom, is Ittai Hagiti. Ittai Hagiti was a non-Jew. The Gemara says, Ittai Hagiti, after David took the crown, Ittai Hagiti then was mevatel it. He nullified it from being an avodah zarah, because it was no longer owned by the Ammon people. They were conquered, and therefore all the spoils become owned by the conqueror, who is David. So therefore they can't hold on, they can't say, "Well, we don't want it to become nullified, it's not theirs anymore." So David then had Ittai come, and I don't know if he had to actually take possession of it, or he just nullified, he nullified the avodah zarah, and then it was used as David's crown. What is the symbolism in that? So the symbolism in that is that besides the obvious symbolism of that all the power and all of the grandeur of this most powerful nation is now totally given over to the Jewish people, but even that which was designated for their idol is nullified. The idolatry is nullified. There's no longer room for idolatry. Once Hashem's kingdom is in place, idolatry is exposed for the foolishness that it is, and there is no room for it. And it becomes all anything that is valuable in the world comes to the service of Hashem. This crown now, it's not really sitting on his head, it's suspended over his head, becomes the symbol of the fact that the city, that last vestige of power among the non-Jews has been removed, has been beaten, and it is all now serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But you have to know something else about Rabbas Bnei Amon, about this place. We know that when the Jews came to Eretz Yisrael, when the Jews came from Mitzrayim, and we came to Eretz Yisrael, at the end of the 40 years, so we know that we came to Eretz Yisrael from east to west. And at the end of the 40 years, we came from east to west. Now, we know that the Chumash tells us we could not go through the land of Edom, which was in the south of Eretz Yisrael, and we could not go through the land of Moab, which was southeast of Eretz Yisrael, because they didn't give us permission. We also couldn't go through the land of Ammon, which was east of Eretz Yisrael, because they didn't give us permission. And we would have been locked out of Eretz Yisrael. We would have been landlocked out of Eretz. There was no way to get through. But Ammon u'Moav tiharu b'sichon. Hashem brought Sichon and Og, and they conquered parts of Moab and Ammon. And when they conquered those parts, they were no longer owned by Moab and Ammon, which enabled us to come in and conquer them. Because once those lands were annexed by Sichon and Og, well, Sichon and Og were fair game. They weren't off limits. Moab, Ammon, Edom, they were off limits. But Sichon and Og were not off limits. So we were able to conquer the lands that they had conquered from Moab and Ammon. And that provided us a tiny, bridgehead to get through the lands of Moab and Ammon. We actually went between their two lands. And then we came to the Eiver HaYarden, we came to the east side of the Jordan River, which was owned by Sichon and Og. We conquered that became our land. Og was in part of the lands that were owned by Ammon. Og was in the northern part of the eastern side of the Jordan River, which was the part that was owned by Ammon. And he had conquered their lands, and then we conquered him and took over those lands. Now, this rivalry between Og and Ammon goes back a long way. Because the Chumash tells us, this is in Parashas Devarim that I'm going to read to you. I'll tell you chapter and verse in a moment. The Chumash tells us that when we were not allowed to attack Ammon, it says in... Plus, it's Perek Beis, second chapter, Pasuk. I'm going to read to you starting with Pasuk Yud Tes 19. Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu, "V'karavta mul b'nei Ammon." You're going to get close to where Ammon lives. Al titzurim al tiskabam. Don't start up with them. Ki lo etei meretz b'nei Ammon l'cha Yerusha. I will not give you any of the land of Ammon because I gave it to Lot. Now, Pasuk Chav verse 20. Eretz Rifa'im techashev afhi. That land is known as the land of Rifa'im, or giants. Rifa'im yashuvah lefanim. The giants used to live there. V'hamonim yukulem zamzumim. The Ammonim called them zamzumim, whatever we learn from that. Am gadol v'rab v'ram kanakim. They were these powerful, powerful nations, like giants. V'yashmidem Hashem ifayhem. Hashem destroyed those giants from before the Bnei Ammon, by Yirashuma Yishu Sachtam, and they, the Bnei Ammon, destroyed them and dwelled in their place. The land of Ammon was a land of giants, and Hashem destroyed them and gave the land to Ammon. Then later, Og, who was the sole remaining giant, came back. And Hashem gave Og the ability to win back some of those lands. That enabled us to take those lands, because we couldn't take it from Ammon, so we could take it from Og. But here, listen to this. When the Torah is describing Og later on, The Torah says, I'm reading you now the next chapter, Perek Gimel, chapter 3, Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11. Ki rak Og melech HaBashan nishar. Only Og, the king of Bashan, remained. Mieser HaRefoim, from the leftovers of the giants. Hinei arso eres barzel. You should know that his either his bed or his crib was an iron bed or crib, meaning a wooden one wouldn't support him. He was very, very big. He needed a metal one. Halohi, you know where it is? You know where this bed of Og is? Birabas b'nei Amon. It was located in this city. Teisha Amos Arka, it is 9 Amos long. V'aba Amos Rachban, 4 Amos wide. Now an Amma is between a foot and a half and 2 feet. That's big. But it's not huge. It is big. But V'amas Ish, only measuring according to the Amos of Og. An Amma would be from here to here. So it was 9 Amos by 4 Amos measured in Og's Amos, which doesn't tell us anything. Because Og's Amos, who knows how big Og's Amos were. But it does tell us the proportion of his body. A normal person is approximately 4 Amos tall, between 3 and 4 Amos tall, and 1 Amma wide. So the proportion is 3 to 1 or 4 to 1. He was 9 to 4. So he didn't look like a regular human being. I don't know how tall, because we don't know what measurement we're using. We don't know what standard we're using with the word Amma. But whatever it is, he didn't look like a regular person. So his bed, which measured according to his proportions, and the fact it was a gigantic bed and it was made of iron, was something that the Ammonim held on to. They kept it as a symbol of their unbelievable victory over the giants. Because they didn't look at it as Hashem destroying the giants for them. They looked at it as, we destroyed the giants. And look at this bed. Look who used to live here. The greatest of them all, Og. The only one who escaped. Here's that bed. That's where Og's bed was. In this city, in the capital city of Ammon, the last stronghold, they had this bed to show off their incredible power. Of course, the Torah says, they had no power at all. Hashem destroyed the giants in order to bring in Ammon. But they looked at it as their own power. So that's Rabbas B'nai Ammon. That's this place. And it is this place that David finally conquers, ending all resistance to Hashem's kingdom. And now the stage is set for the Beis HaMikdash. And with that, the nullifying of their idolatry, taking that incredible crown, and it gets put over the head of David. But there's one last thing. Yes, go ahead.
When they took the crown and put it over the head of David, wouldn't that enable the people to want to worship David?
Right. So you have to say, because it never happens. We do find a king later on gets worshipped. Yehoash eventually gets worshipped. And that's a big problem. And we'll learn that about that Mirz Hashem in Malachim. And we pay for it for many years afterwards. David, that never happened. So you have to say that David was so obviously an Eved Hashem, no one would worship him.
So all the other people who were idol worshippers.
Yeah, they wouldn't. They wouldn't think of it. He was so given over to Hashem. It was obvious. It was like, yeah. But yes.
What crown did Og wear?
I don't know. It's a good question. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Are you suggesting that perhaps this crown started as Og's crown? That's not a bad idea. I don't know. That's interesting.
Because they would have kept it too. You would think whatever crown Og had, they would have kept.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Okay, I don't know. Good question. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Okay. Mm-hmm. But then David takes the people of Ammon and he subjects them to afflictions and to degradations, which makes them an example for everybody else. He takes this last hold out, this last vestige of the ones who are trying to keep Hashem's kingdom from coming to fruition, and he makes an example out of them so that no one else would think of trying to undermine the progress of bringing the world closer to Hashem and building the Beis HaMikdash. And that the end of the story is where we had to get to. We had to get to the beginning of the story was you had this last holdout. See, this is what you can't miss this in the story of David and Bathsheba. The story of David and Bathsheba is against the backdrop of this city. The beginning of the story, two chapters ago, was with the battle for Rabbah. And it ends with the conquering of Rabbah. It's what happens in the process. What was supposed to happen and what actually happened. But it is all within the context of the last stronghold. And when it finally comes down, it's now time for the Beis HaMikdash, really. But first Shlomo Melech has to grow up. David can't build the Beis HaMikdash. The question one can ask, which I don't know if I have a good answer for you for this one, is what would have been David's mission had he done it right? Meaning that had he not jumped the gun and had everything gone as planned and he would have married Bathsheba and had Mashiach, he still has to wait for Mashiach to grow up. And David has to die 12 years later, and maybe within 13 years later with the first child. Perhaps it would have been because you have a pregnancy. It could be the child would have been 13 because David's going to die at age 70. So evidently when the first child is born, David is approximately 57, and when Shlomo is born, he's possibly 58. So the child would have been 13 years old. So there's this 13 years of David, Bathsheba, Mashiach growing up. What is David's mission? So the only thing I can think of is David's mission is to train Mashiach, to raise Mashiach, to bring him up in a way that he is ready to be Mashiach. Because to be Mashiach, it must be, right? The Rambam says Mashiach will be greater in wisdom than Shlomo. Greater in wisdom than Shlomo. Shlomo is the Chacham Mikol Adam, he's the wisest of all men. Right? That's the handful in and of itself. But even though that really happens after David dies. But the Mashiach is going to be more wise than Shlomo. And he'll be second in Nevuah, second in prophecy, to Moshe Rabbeinu. Which means he'll be a bigger prophet than David HaMelech himself. So if you're raising that child, I imagine it takes a great deal of forethought, etc. So I imagine it would have been 13 years, which makes sense, is Bar Mitzvah, 13 years of raising Mashiach ben David to be Mashiach ben David. I guess that's what it would have been. What's actually going to happen is for the next 12 years, David is going to be dealing with the fallout from this episode with rebellions and problems within his own family. That's what he's going to be dealing with, which we're constantly going to have to explain how it all is there as a tikkun, as a way of correcting what went wrong. But that's what's going to end up happening now. So Shlomo HaMelech is going to be raised against the backdrop of all the problems that David HaMelech is going to have. And that's the way he'll be raised. Okay, so we will stop here.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.